Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to kick things off now because the topic. I might say that Angela and Sam have put this morning together a fantastic effort. The topic they're covering is huge. We've sort of broken it down to manageable bite-sized bits, I think. I'm still not sure how they'll finish. And there are four topics. The first deals with burden, which by and large is a topic that can be regarded as how you prove your case, and quite how one grapples with that in a 15-minute session, I'm not entirely sure, but that's the guts of evidence, I think. We'll move on to the second topic, will be documentary evidence, with an emphasis, of course, on business records. The third is oral evidence. And then the final segment will be a broader topic. We would and do encourage questions and topics that people might like covered. Could they please raise them? I think a bit of it with this sort of topic, a discussion from people about experiences and difficulties that have arisen is very useful for the rest of us, because there's no way that any one person can be able to get up and say they are an expert in tax, in evidence in tax litigation. The two speakers are both have very solid practices in tax litigation, and Angela, both are young-ish to the bar. Angela came here in 2011, Sam I think in about 2008, was it? 2008. Angela, before arriving at the bar, was at Minter Ellison, and prior to that at PricewaterhouseCoopers. Sam spent some time with Justice Maxwell, and before that was with Alan Arthur Robinson. Angela was telling me that she was recently in a case where their star witness actually wasn't alive, and the evidence that they had to rely upon consisted of his hearsay allegations recorded on a 264, section 264 examination transcript, and that much time was spent considering how one makes use of such star evidence as consists of that type of material. Not surprisingly, the case settled. Sam has been involved in the promoter penalty cases, which does bring a different approach to tax litigation so far as practitioners are concerned, because it's the only area in which the onus is on the commissioner. And so he's had the almost exclusive experience of having been in a case where he's been required to, on behalf of the commissioner, to lead evidence to prove positively the conduct of a tax avoidance scheme. So we'll move on to the first topic, which is effectively one of onus and burden, and I'm not sure which of the two speakers are speaking first, but I'll invite him or her to come up.
Thank you, Greg. I might launch straight into it. As many of you in this room will know, in a tax dispute, the taxpayer can choose between the federal court or the tribunal, but in either case, the taxpayer would have the onus of proving that the assessment is excessive. The tribunal is not bound by the rules of evidence, whereas the court is. But however, the tribunal, as a matter of practice, tends to adopt the rules of evidence anyway, and that's a topic that Sam will explore later on. There is no onus on the commissioner to show that the assessment is correct. And a taxpayer will generally discharge his or her burden of proving that an assessment is excessive by proving that the actual taxable income, in truth, is less than the amounts assessed. The standard of proof is a civil standard of the balance of probabilities. Now, in practice, a taxpayer can often agree at least some of the facts with the commissioner, and that way narrow the facts that are in dispute. The taxpayer can then focus his or her efforts on leading evidence of the facts that are in dispute. The legal onus falls on the taxpayer, but the evidentiary onus may shift. So once the taxpayer puts his or her evidence on, the commissioner might very quickly need to address that evidence that's been put on. Now, I just want to address a special class of assessments, which are the default assessments under Section 167. It's a very powerful provision for the Commissioner. He can, under that section, issue default assessments, for example, in the case where a taxpayer fails to lodge a return or where the Commissioner is not satisfied with a return that has been lodged. Under Section 167, the Commissioner makes an assessment of an amount upon which, in his judgment, income tax ought to be levied. The amount, that number, that amount becomes the taxpayer's taxable income. Sure. In the case of a 167 assessment, the Commissioner is not required to show how he arrived at that taxable income, that number. He doesn't have to prove the elements of it. So he doesn't have to show what the assessable income is and what the deductions are. The onus is on the taxpayer to prove that the amount of the assessment is excessive. As the High Court has said, it is no part of the duty of the Commissioner to establish affirmatively what judgment he formed, much less the grounds of it, and even less still, the truth of the facts affording the grounds. And that was in the case of George in 1952. It's not enough for a taxpayer in the case of a 167 assessment to show that the Commissioner has made an error in forming the judgment of that number. And also, the taxpayer cannot pick and choose elements that he doesn't like in the calculation. So, for example, he can't say, I'll take the Commissioner's 167 number, but the assessable income is too high or the deductions are too low. Now, it's not difficult to see how in such a case that the burden of proof on the taxpayer can be very problematic for someone who may not keep records or sufficient records. But in that context, the High Court has said that it's clear that the legislature did not intend to confer upon a potential taxpayer the valuable privilege of disqualifying himself in making the correct assessment by the simple and relatively unskilled method of losing either his memory or his books. So the burden falls hard on the taxpayer. Now, in the context of tax litigation, contemporaneous written evidence is often very useful to help support a taxpayer's case, but these may not always be available. And in these situations, it may be possible for the taxpayer to ask the court or the tribunal to draw an inference based on the available evidence, which we will talk further about a little later on. I'll hand over to Sam.
One of the questions we asked ourselves was about the difference between the tribunal and an appeal in the federal court from the point of view of the evidentiary process, and our conclusion, I think, is that there isn't that evidentiary processes won't be the deciding factor in choosing between the tribunal and the court in many cases. It's far more likely, in our view, that a taxpayer will elect to go to the tribunal because of reasons such as the power, the different power that the tribunal has to exercise, the different costs, consequences likely to flow from issuing in the tribunal, and maybe in some cases the confidentiality orders that the tribunal can make. But certainly evidence and the way evidence will be treated is going to be a factor in deciding whether to issue in the Administrative Appeals Tribunal. The rule appears to be that whilst of course the tribunal isn't bound by the rules of evidence, in practice it does follow them, and the rationale usually given is, well, the rules of evidence constitute the collective learning of the law over many centuries about the way reliable evidence is to be found, and on that basis it's appropriate the tribunal observe them. Having that in mind then, the tribunal will of course hear and deal with objections to evidence, and in my experience, and certainly that experience relates especially to small matters in the tribunal, a good approach is to make an objection which refers to the guiding principle informing a rule of evidence rather than going to the rule itself. For example, if a piece of evidence sought to be led is hearsay, explain why it isn't reliable for a particular witness to give that evidence, rather than jumping up and down and talking about hearsay and the hearsay rule. The extent to which the tribunal is going to observe the formal rules of evidence will also depend on the matter and the approach of the parties to their matter. So, for example, in a recent R&D expenditure case in which Silk and Junior were briefed on both sides, the tribunal decided it was appropriate for it to apply the rules of evidence formally, and it did so having notified the parties that that's what it proposed to do. One issue that sometimes arises in relation to proceedings in the tribunal is the notion that the taxpayer can object to the content of the T documents, and I'm not convinced of the value of doing that. I'd be grateful to hear from the room if there is any experience around that proposition, but my understanding is that the T documents are meant to be all documents that the Commissioner considers necessary to the review of an objection decision, and on that basis are rather fixed by the language of Part 4C once that decision is made by the Commissioner. In practical terms, of course, if a taxpayer wants a document included in the T documents, their first step would be to telephone their counterpart at the ATO and ask them to whether the ATO has a view about including that document. That's really it on AAT.
Was that it on burden?
Yes.
I just wanted to make a couple of points. Some obvious ones. Burden, it means that right at the start of your case, you have to look at what you have to prove in order to succeed. And you then, you sit down, make a list of the facts that need to be proved in order to succeed, and you then look at what evidence you've got, and you present your evidence accordingly. That's a pretty general, broad comment, probably obvious, but that's what defines the way in which litigation is run. The second point to make is on the question of what you've got available. You can prove things by inference. The federal court, I think a little bit more so than the tribunal, that's just a feeling, I might be wrong, but the federal court is happy to infer facts if there's no direct evidence, and the absence of direct evidence is explained, But there is evidence of surrounding circumstances, and it's produced to the court, and the court makes an inference. So one should bear the utility of proving cases through proving surrounding facts and inviting inferences as a matter that you keep in back of your mind when preparing cases. The third was that, as Sam sort of touched upon a couple of days ago, I think both Angela and Sam said to me, have you had experiences where the choice of the jurisdiction has turned upon a decision about the type of evidence that you have available? In my own experience, I've not decided whether to institute in the federal court or to institute in the tribunal because of the particular evidence that we have. The decision to go into the tribunal, the court's dictated more by other things, such as the need to obtain the exercise of the discretion. All right, I think we should move on to the next topic, which is business records.
Well, 166 and 167 assessments, of course, deal with the situation where taxpayers' records are deficient. A far better situation, usually, for the taxpayer is where their records are fulsome, and in that case, they will need to rely on the business records rule to get around the hearsay rule, which would otherwise exclude evidence of a previous representation made outside of court. Now, there's a very good rationale for the business records rule, and it's worth keeping that rationale in mind when one analyses the business records rule. The rationale is simple. It is in the interests of a business to keep accurate records, and therefore the records are treated as reliable. In fact, there are numerous judgments in which judges have expressed the view that business records are likely to be more reliable than memory. Against that background, then, the business records rule, which appears in section 69 of the Evidence Act, is generally given a liberal interpretation. But it needs to be borne in mind by practitioners that the criteria of application of the business records rule must themselves be satisfied by evidence. Now, sometimes it is possible for a court to draw inferences from the face of the documents, but not always. One of the techniques that might be used in a court to deal with the issue of admissibility of business records is a notice to admit. And I wanted to invite any members of the audience who've had experience in using that process in a tax case to share them at the conclusion of this discussion. But what I propose to do now is to break down the business records rule into its constituent components. The first is that the document either is or forms part of the records belonging to or kept by an organisation in the course of or for the purposes of a business, or at any time formed part of such a record. And those are expansive words. They include emails. They include drafts of documents. They include a note made by an individual in the course of performing their work within an organisation that is a business, even if the note is made for that individual's own purposes. They include invoices from entity A to entity B, either in the hands of A or B. But what about representations contained in documents that don't have the quality of needing to be accurate in order to be relied upon for the operation of the business? For example, a representation in a letter received by the business, or a representation in a complaint received by the business. These are cases which, in my opinion, are at the limits of the type of document which can be records belonging to or kept by a business containing representations made or recorded in the course of or for the purposes of a business. And there are some judicial comments to that effect. In one case, Justice Spurling in the New South Wales Supreme Court made the point that promotional matter may not qualify for admission under the business records rule. So flyers, website publications, these are things that contain representations which, as Honour said, are justifiably received with healthy scepticism. Similarly, books, magazines and newspapers may not be business records admissible as to the truth of the representations they contain. And it's worth remembering, of course, that that material might be admissible for other purposes, such as for evidence of the making of the representation, and that would be a matter relevant, for example, in a promoter penalty case where it's the fact of the representation rather than its truth that is relevant. There is a separate decision in Russell and the Federal Commissioner of Taxation where an industry group associated with forestry activities produced an information sheet containing what was referred to as a case study with some costings for a small forestry operation, and Justice Logan in that case was prepared to admit that document under the business records rule. Dealing with the requirement of in the course of or for the purposes of a business is defined pretty broadly in the Evidence Act, and it includes an activity engaged in or carried on by the Crown in any of its capacities. That means that the Commissioner's records can be business records. The Commissioner's got another way of getting his records into evidence, and that is via Section 182 of the Evidence Act, which extends the operation of the business records rule in respect of a category of documents which are referred to in the Act as Commonwealth records. And interestingly, it appears that Commonwealth records can extend to forms completed by third parties and submitted to a Commonwealth agency. Again, in my view, this is right at the limits of what the business records rule in principle is intended to do. There is a case that I came across in researching this rule where a Fair Work Australia in a civil penalties proceeding adduced evidence of a complaint form completed by a member of the public about an employer. And the Federal Circuit Court judge admitted that complaint form into evidence under the Commonwealth Records extension of the business records rule. One would have to ask oneself whether such a document has that inherent reliability of a business record. The next requirement is that the representation contained in the document be made by a person who had or might reasonably be supposed to have had personal knowledge of the asserted fact. Well, what is it reasonable to suppose a person knew? In many cases, this has been a matter that courts are prepared to determine by inference from the face of the document. In other words, it hasn't been necessary in every case for the person seeking to adduce the document to prove the identity of the person who made the representation in the document. And one can imagine, for example, a customer relations management database in which a call centre operator records information about an interaction with a client on a daily basis. That call centre operator may or may not be available, identifiable from interrogation of the database. Well, the courts have in general taken a reasonably pragmatic approach to this requirement and a reasonably broad approach to what might reasonably be supposed. in the matter of Guest and the Federal Commissioner of Taxation, there were on loan account statements some handwritten markings that indicated that certain checks had been received, and those handwritten markings, although the person who made them wasn't identified, were admitted as evidence of the representation that the checks had been, were admitted as evidence of the fact represented in them that the checks had been received. In the case of BHP and the Commissioner of Taxation, a 1999 case in the Federal Court, there were some documents that the Commissioner had obtained from the IRS in the United States. Those documents contained a request by lawyers acting for GE for a ruling from the IRS, and the entities in respect of which the ruling was requested had been now formed part of the BHP corporate group. The Commissioner sought to tender those letters, and Justice Kenny refused to make the finding that the authors of the letters might reasonably be supposed to have had knowledge of the facts asserted in the letters. So there is a case, an example of a case where the inference wasn't drawn in favour of the party seeking to attempt to adduce the documents. Finally, there's an exception to the hearsay rule, or a carve-out, I should say, in subparagraph 3A. It applies where documents were prepared or obtained for the purpose of conducting or for or in contemplation of or in connection with an Australian or overseas proceeding. Not hard to see why there would be that carve-out from the business records rule. This may well exclude representations that were recorded by an officer of the Commissioner investigating breaches, for example, of the promoter penalties provisions, where proceedings are likely in contemplation as arising from that investigation.
Should we? Well, let's finish this. Yeah. How long will you be?
I'll just try to cover off on just one issue really quickly. So it's something that Greg mentioned at the beginning. It's trying to get a 264 transcript in. So we did work on this, and the Commissioner may want to admit the transcripts, for example, if it contains a prior inconsistent statement. And in my view, the transcript would be admissible to the extent that it contains representations made by a person who had personal knowledge of the asserted facts, subject to the court's discretions to exclude evidence under section 135 or to limit the use of evidence under 136. So the New South Wales Supreme Court has said that if a person observes, so that's sees, hears or perceives something, that observation may be the subject of a representation in the relevant document. But if that person forms a conclusion or an opinion about the state of mind of another person, that would not be something that's seen, heard or perceived in that context. Now, the Commissioner may wish to cross-examine on a prior inconsistent statement, but what if you're acting for a taxpayer and you're aware that there is a prior inconsistent statement? One issue that you may face is that you'd have to be careful not to mislead the court. What you can do in that context is to lead evidence on the prior inconsistent statements, that is to get it out in the open and give the representor a chance to explain the inconsistency. Also, one thing to keep in mind is that it may be better for you to be able to lead that evidence in chief rather than to leave it to the other side to cross-examine on the prior inconsistent statement only. Another very quick issue is what if the representor has died since the 264 interview. In that case, in addition to what I've just said under business records, I think the transcript may also be admissible under another provision, which is section 63, relating to circumstances where the maker of the representation is no longer available.
Any questions on business records or
264 transcripts. And Sam raised the issue about notices to admit. The utility of notices to admit, of course, has dropped away a little bit these days, but in the federal court, because the court demands that the parties get together before proceedings get underway and work out where the elements, parts of where the dispute lies and what's agreed and what's not. So it's been a while since I've seen a notice to admit. It's still a very useful tool, I think. Should be kept in mind. All right, we'll have a break for 7 minutes.